When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, you're listening to Rock and or Roll, part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. I'm BJ, and continuing the Power Pop series, today I present to you an interview I conducted with Parthenon Huxley. He got his start in a band called the Blazers out of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. At the time, he went by Rick Miller, and he played guitar and sang and wrote for that band. They had one album called How to Rock that came out in 1980. After that, he started going by Rick Rock and put out a single in 1983 called Buddha Buddha, and that song was also on a compilation on Dolphin Records called Mondo Montage. That single got him some recognition. He had a couple more songs on the sequel to Mondo Montage, More Mondo. He eventually landed a record deal with Columbia and released an album called Sunny Nights in 1988. And by that time, he had changed his name to Parthenon Huxley. Sunday Nights and the Columbia deal didn't really go anywhere, and he would resurface a few years later, but now going by P. Hux. As P. Hux, he put out a CD in 1995 called Deluxe that got him a lot of attention in the underground power pop scene. And as P. Hux, he has gone on to release 5 or 6 more albums and a couple of compilations. And in 1999, he joined ELO2. Okay, so let's hear the interview with Parthenon Huxley. I think this is a great conversation about making your way in the music business and how, even if you're not necessarily famous, you could still make a living, develop a devoted fan base, and basically maintain a career out of the spotlight, but a special sort of personal relationship with your fans, and turn that into a career. And Parthenon Huxley, or P. Hux, pulled it off. Well, would you be interested in like telling the story of the Blazers? The Blazers is an interesting one because it's not. Well, I wonder, the one thing I've been asking everybody is, what do you think of the term power pop? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I see this argued online sometimes. Ultimately, I don't think it really matters what you call anything.
Right.
But to me, it's the second. You know, it's the second wave. It's the early bands that were influenced by the Beatles, you know, the second wave, like Raspberries and Badfinger and, you know, Big Star and all these bands where it was the first time that you said, oh, they sound like the Beatles, who weren't contemporaries of the Beatles, you know?
Right.
And of course, that's been going on for 50 years now. So, I mean, there's obviously I'm a Beatle guy and the influence is never ending. In fact, they're pretty much my religion. But that's what power pop is. And I guess the other side of that is, since the Beatles sounded like a little bit of everything, you could also say that power pop has a little bit more of the Who involved in it, or, you know, a little more balls and guts. But I think it's basically just all us who really love a bashing kind of rock band with pretty melodies, you know?
Right.
That's sort of what it is to me. It rocks, but it's pretty. That's kind of my favorite thing, like a beautiful melody over a fucking rocking band, you know?
Let's see. What year did the Blazers record come out? Was it 80? Yeah, 1980. So yeah. The Blazers is more, a lot of it's just a rock and roll record, right? But there's certain songs like Don't Worry About It Now. That's kind of a great power pop song.
Blazers was a funny story. I was like a junior in college at UNC Chapel Hill, and the leader of the Blazers was this guy named Sherman Tate. And the Blazers, the original Blazers, were kind of just almost like an R&B and rockabilly and rock and roll sort of cover band. And they had a few original songs, and they made a record back when making a record was really rare. So if you had a record in the stores, it was like, oh, that's amazing, you know. Mm-hmm. And they had an album that wasn't very good, but it was okay. And Sherman was the front man, and he was an okay guitarist and an okay singer, but he really brought a lot of energy. Like, people loved watching him because he really kind of he envisioned himself as kind of a badass rockabilly guy, and people loved it. And it was, you know, and you could dance to the Blazers. So he ran into me at the he worked at a record store. And he said, hey, our bass player and guitar player are both leaving. Do you want to think about maybe joining the Blazers? And so me and this guy, Lee Gildersleeve, joined the band. And I had just, around that time, had broken up with the first love of my life. So I had a whole shitload of songs.
Right.
So I started, you know, suddenly I had a vehicle for my songs. And we learned, you know, 6, 8, 10 of my songs. And the Blazers kind of turned into a hybrid cover rock and roll pop band, power pop band. Like, my stuff was really Beatly, and so we started to sound more like a early Tom Petty or Dwight Twilley or, you know, or Rock Pile, all those kind of bands that were sort of rock and roll plus Liverpool, you know, like kind of a Memphis Liverpool hybrid. So that's what the Blazers were. When we made that album, Don Dixon, the producer, we opened for his band Arrogance, and he heard our sound check and he said, "Hey, how many of your songs is the band doing?" And I said, "No, about, you know, 8 or 10. He says, "I think we ought to make a record." So it was kind of a perfect timing for me to be in a band playing all my songs and making a record, which I think I put 6 original songs on there, and we had 2 covers and 2 of Sherman's. So that's how that came about. It wasn't like I formed the Blazers and wanted to be Rockpile or anything like that. It just sort of turned into that once my songs got incorporated into the set. 1 year of love. Essentially, you got to remember, this is back in the days of playing 3 sets a night for the weekend, like Friday, Saturday, and sometimes even Sunday. Your job was to play 3 sets a night and fill the dance floor, you know, back when people actually went to see live music and dance and get drunk and shit. So the choice of songs that Sherman brought to the band were always kind of up-tempo. It could be Elvis Costello, Rodney Crowell, or the Stones, or whatever. It was just songs that people would dance to, you know. So my originals kind of snuck into that and got blended in with all these songs that people knew, and it went over well, and that's how that happened.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about how being a record collector in the 90s, like before the internet, you would buy a lot of records just based on what it looked like, trying to figure out if you would like it. And one of the warning signs for me that I might not like it would be if the band had too many mustaches. And it's funny how everybody in the Blazers has a mustache, you know. So I would have been
I think Sherman and Ronnie had beards, which is right. A little more acceptable. But I had that horrible first mustache of my life, you know.
Yeah.
Oh God, I know. And I have a can of Strohs in my hand too, so it's pretty bad. But you know, you're living life. You're not really watching what you're doing. You're just sort of doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if I remember right, the first time I heard the Blazers record was there was a guy I used to trade rare stuff with through the mail, and I think he sent me probably a cassette tape of it.
And who was that?
It was actually a guy who I think he was a professor at MIT. He sent me a lot of really cool stuff back then.
That's a trip.
And I'm betting that I probably knew who you were and didn't know you were in the Blazers until later, like somehow figured that out at some point. It's always fun to make those connections, you know, and realize, oh, this is what he did back then.
Yeah, I love finding out where everybody was, because every overnight success has about 10 to 20 years of shit behind him, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, not that I was ever an overnight success, but...
But I think if I had come across the Blazers record in a record store back then, I probably wouldn't have bought it just by looking at it.
Especially... No, absolutely. I mean, when we used to shop, you know, when you had 10 bucks to your name, you had to be really careful what you'd buy. So I always looked to see if the band looked cool. First of all, they had to look amazing, you know?
Yeah.
But like I said, the Blazers was not my cool new wave band by any means. It was a hybrid sort of, it was either a beautiful hybrid or a mess. You could, you know, you could call it whatever you wanted to. And again, I wasn't, I didn't have the vision or whatever to try to form some cool new wave band that would, you know, could compete nationally. After I left the Blazers, I tried that a couple of times. I had a band called the Dads, and we tried to do that and got a little bit of traction. And then I did Rick Rock, which actually got more traction. But I never designed a band to fit in. I was never that smart or calculating. I always just wanted a band that could play my songs,
right?
No matter what they were, you know, and I felt like I've always had a good radar, a good personal radar. Like I know when I've got a good song. I've thrown out many more than anybody will ever hear. I think I know what a strong song is, at least when I write it. And that was always my only ambition, was to hear the stuff that was in my head be out there live playing for people, and no matter what it was. So sometimes I would almost veer toward on trend, and other times I completely wasn't. I've never really been guided by that, and my career has always kind of happened at odd times, you know, like Sunny Nights, you know, in 1988, there really wasn't anything else like that coming out. You know, it was a lot of hair metal and all that kind of shit, but that's the record I wanted to make, you know. Maybe Crowded House was probably the only other thing around that time that I felt was in that ballpark. You know what I mean? So I never had a plan to fit into the scene, even if I admired a scene a whole lot. Like if I love the Plimsolls and all these other bands that I thought were really cool at that time.
Right.
If I wasn't writing Plimsolls type of music, I certainly wasn't going to try. You know, it was always just what was coming out of my head.
If I've made power pop compilations in the past, Don't Worry About It Now would be the song that I would pick off the Blazers record to put on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember writing that. I remember exactly where I was and showing it to my friend, Matt Barrett. And I just felt like, oh, this is, I've got something really good here. I mean, I hear it now. It's pretty simple, you know, I think the emotion is intact. You know, it was sincere.
Yeah. If Rhino, you know, put out a power pop box set or something, definitely that song, I would put it on there if I was curating it, you know. Especially given your history afterwards, you know, that would be another reason to include it. But so the Mondo Montage compilation, so that's on Dolphin Records. I think the only other album I have on Dolphin is the Tommy Keane Places That Are Gone record.
Great record. Yep.
Yeah. Did you
know
Dolphin
him? Dolphin grew up. I knew Tommy a little bit. We toured. I had a thing with Don Dixon called Me and Dixon, where we do our show was half his songs and half mine. And we toured the Northeast with Let's Active and Tommy Keane.
Cool.
Really nice little bill.
Yeah.
And Tommy was, Dolphin was out of Durham, North Carolina, but more specifically, it was out of the Record Bar chain of stores. It was kind of birthed out of that corporation. And headed by a guy named Josh Greer, who is still a music attorney, I see his name every couple of years. If some big court case comes out, it's usually Josh Greer is involved with it, or management. But yeah, so their first thing they wanted to do was get themselves on the map with a compilation of North Carolina bands, and everybody sent their stuff in. And I was the only guy to get two songs on the album, so I felt pretty proud of myself.
Yeah.
And so Boot and Sputnik got a lot of attention and a review in Rolling Stone that was really positive.
I'm a looking for a Sputnik. I'm a looking for a Sputnik.
Everybody in the village,
After the Blazers, I was in this band, The Dads, and then I decided to not be in any more Democratic bands where, you know, here's one by the drummer.
Yeah.
So I formed Rick Rock with two guys I didn't know before the band. Like, I just picked out a great drummer in town and a great bass player, and Andy Church and Chip Shelby. And we rehearsed for 9 months before anybody heard us live in person. And I just had this, I was kind of 26, kind of peaking with my ambition, I guess, and really on fire and writing a song a day and that kind of shit. So we had like 20 songs. We had two songs on the album. We had a review in Rolling Stone, and then we came out and played live, and we had a full set that was completely rehearsed, and people were kind of blown away. And that was probably one of the few times in my life where I actually had a plan and executed it.
Yeah.
And it worked well, you know, we were really good, and we started moving up from just playing clubs to opening for national acts. Like, I opened for Berlin, Romantics, and REM, and started to do that level of show, which was kind of the next up from just kicking around the clubs. And I started to feel like maybe I do have something here, you know, like maybe this could happen. I still didn't know how the hell to make it happen, because I was in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I wasn't in New York or LA, and I didn't know anybody in the industry other than people like Don Dixon. So we went on my girlfriend at the time booked us a tour that was really crazy. We went from like Chapel Hill to South Carolina to Texas to Indiana to Nebraska. You know, it was like, oh my God. And the van broke down in Nebraska, and the drummer said, I'm going to go back to North Carolina, get my job at the nuclear plant. Sorry, I can't take this anymore. Cause he had to pay for the broken van. And the drummer, bass player went with him, and my girlfriend and I went to her mom's house in Chicago to lick our wounds for a while. And that was the end of Rick Rock. It was like 9 months of prep and maybe 9 months of touring. And that was it. But that song, Buddha Buddha, really kind of unlocked a lot of stuff for me.
Try to rise above the petty things I run into. I think of love when I do everything I do. Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. Fishing boats in the Greek blue sea go. Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. Enemy planes in the comic books go. Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. Young hearts when they fall in love go. Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. I live in a different world. A private solitude.
Well, it was a very popular song. It got played a lot on college radio in North Carolina, and it was voted one of the 10 best records ever made in North Carolina by the Greensboro newspaper. And people still write to me about it. It's like one of their favorite songs from that period of the early 80s. And it was also a different kind of song from me. I felt really naked with the lyric, like saying stuff like everything I do, Buddha did with love, and that's what I aspire to. I thought that was really... I felt exposed, like, oh my God, are people going to bust me on that? And of course, nobody did, because they like, you know that part I like? Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. They like that part. So we never know what we're doing. But I felt like that was a concise statement of in support of the concept of love, disguised in a catchy little song. So that was kind of my mission at the time, I think.
And so is the Mondo Montage record a pretty good representation of the scene at the time in Chapel Hill?
I think so. Are X-Teens on it?
Yeah.
And X-Teens and the States, Fabulous Knob.
The States already had a couple of major label records out before this, but this is my favorite song by the band on here, the one that Don't Call My Name Anymore.
I don't even know if I remember that. Were they from South Carolina, maybe?
Maybe. They had two records out before this. The second one was called Picture Me With You. I think it was on one of those labels like Portrait or one of those where the majors were pretending to have an indie label at the time kind of thing.
Right, right. I don't remember the States. I think they might have been from South Carolina. I might be remembering wrong, but I think Don Dixon had a song on there and Let's Active was on there. So I think it was a pretty fair representation of what was going on. The coolest bands ever down there were like the DBs and H-Bombs and Let's Active and all that. All those guys from Winston-Salem. You know, they kind of made their mark and got associated with Stamey was associated with Big Star and all that. So back in the 70s and 80s, Chapel Hill was kind of an island almost. I just felt like we had our scene down there, and if anybody ever discovered it, fine. But there wasn't a mad rush to try to join the mainstream. I think we always thought we were cooler than the mainstream, maybe, or something. You know, looking back on it, the big context, I mean, we always wanted to be recognized, but Chapel Hill was not full of showmen. Do you know what I mean? Like Van Halen could never come out of Chapel Hill because Chapel Hill was just too cool. You'd wear your jeans and your t-shirt on stage and, you know, you could be animated, but if you were posing like a rock star, you'd be ridiculed, you know?
Yeah, it's that totally alternative vibe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You got to be smart.
Yeah.
A lot of the music is probably not moving your ass. It's more moving your head. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's really where we came from. And I remember hearing Van Halen on the radio for the first time and said, oh my God, just listen to that. There's so much fucking swagger.
Yeah.
it was kind of startling. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I love that shit. I love how great it sounded. I mean, it was took a minute to get used to, but since apparently David Lee Roth didn't even know the words to You Really Got Me. But but anyway, I digress.
Yeah. So how do you go from being Rick Rock to becoming Parthenon Huxley?
Well, Rick Rock was a high school nickname because I went to high school in Greece and there was another Rick over there and he said, let's be a band. You be Rick Rock, I'll be Rick Roll. I said, okay, that's funny.
Rick Roll. Now that means Rick something Roll. Completely different.
Yeah, right? So that's where that came from, just kind of stupid fun. And then, I don't know, I guess I just, I guess it's the prerogative of artists that they can change their name and try that. And I just thought that I was kicking around Parthenon Jones or whatever. I thought that as a shout out to my time of growing up in Greece. And then I liked this book called Island by Aldous Huxley. And I just thought Parthenon Huxley was a cool sounding name. And why not? Why not change my name and, you know, try something a little bit different? And maybe I was trying to move on from Rick Rock, I guess. I do have a rejection letter from Columbia 2 years before Sunny Nights. Steve Ralbowski was an A&R guy there, and he said, might I suggest you change your name? I think the material is stronger than something by something called Rick Rock. So I don't know if that had any real influence, but it might have. But I think I really kind of just remember that I thought it would be fun to be Parthenon Huxley. And so on my 30th birthday, I moved to New York with my girlfriend who had become my wife. And I said, okay, from now on, it's Parthenon Huxley. And moving to New York helped with that change. I didn't have to convince all my friends that I wasn't Rick.
Right. So you went from having a rejection letter from Columbia to getting signed? by Columbia?
Wasn't a straight line, but yeah.
Yeah.
After Rick Rock broke up, after the band broke down in Nebraska and the band mutinied and all that, my heart was broken because I love my little band. And I didn't really want to just go back to Chapel Hill and start over playing in the clubs. I thought we had something, or I thought if we didn't have something bigger than that, I thought at least I might. And so what I really wanted to do was, until that point, whatever record I made, like especially Buddha Buddha and Sputnik, I remember I had like $400. When the hours were done, we were done. You know what I mean? And I thought I'd really love to record two songs with no time limit and no budget restraint. So I went back to the same studio I'd done Buddha, and I said, look, can we work in the off hours? Like when you're done with your paying session, can we make some kind of arrangement where I can come in after hours and we can work on two songs? And if anything ever comes of it, we'll split whatever happens. And he said, yeah. So it took 6 months, but I got in and did two songs. And like every 3 weeks or a month and a half, he'd call and say, okay, come on out. I sent those two songs to about seven labels, and two of them, I think Island and EMI, called me up, from listening to the cassette with the phone number on it, and called me up and said, hey, your two songs were the favorite at our A&R meeting this week. You got any more? And those two songs had taken 6 months. I said, oh, sure. Yeah, I got more. So we quickly put another package together. And long story short, basically I took some meetings with the labels and I got a demo deal with Island. That didn't work. They passed. And then I did a couple more for another label. And I eventually my reel got bigger and bigger with mostly pretty well produced stuff. And then some 4-track demos that I'd done. I moved to New York on my 30th birthday, like I said, and some friends of ours were in a band called Head for Tall Trees. They were like an 80s pop thing around 1986, very synthy and a handsome couple. They got signed to Chrysalis, and a guy named Mark Goldenberg flew out from L.A. to interview with them to be their producer. And Mark Goldenberg brought his manager, a guy named Michael Solomon, up to New York. And so I met Michael Solomon based on the manager guy, based on the recommendation from my friends that said, hey, we really like these guys and they should hear your tape. So I gave Michael Solomon my tape. He really liked it. He said, do you mind if I shop this out in L.A.? And I said, have at it. He put it on he knew the vice president of MCA Music Publishing. He stuck the cassette on his desk and said, please call me after you've heard this. And that was a guy named Rick Shoemaker at MCA who loved the tape. And this guy, Michael Solomon, who I'd only met once, called me in New York and said, how about a publishing deal? And I said, what's that?
Yeah.
And he said, well, they'll give you money to record and they'll only take half of your publishing. So it's a co-publishing deal. I keep all the writer and half the owner share. And they have a studio out here in LA where you can record anytime you want. And I said, Jesus, that sounds pretty good. So I met with Shoemaker. He flew out to New York to do some biz and also to meet me. We went out to dinner. We had a great time. And I signed with MCA, and it was as a songwriter, but what they didn't want me to write for other people. They wanted me to write what would be my album. So I moved out to LA, crashed on different people's couches and started recording. And the good thing about being with MCA was they would thereafter take all the meetings with the labels, like say, hey, we've signed this guy. We think this guy's the next thing. We've signed his publishing. We want to work with a label and take it right to the top, blah, blah, blah. And there was a guy at Columbia named Jamie Cohen who'd heard, he knew Rick Rock. He knew my song Button from the second Mondo Montage album, More Mondo. And he knew that was a song by Rick Rock. And then he heard this Parthenon Huxley tape and there was a song called Button on it. And he said, is Rick Rock Parthenon Huxley?
Right.
So he was interested and intrigued. And he brought along David Kahn, who was the staff producer at Columbia. So suddenly Columbia, probably unbeknownst to that guy, Steve Ralbowski, who had written that rejection letter, Columbia was suddenly interested out on at least the West Coast office was. And so that eventually turned into another demo deal with them. And then Kahn decided to sign me and we made that record.
Yeah. And you already mentioned that at the time you put this record out, it's weird because in the early 80s you had, new wave and power pop was huge, but then you get kind of this period in the late 80s, especially where there's not a lot of records like this. But then in the 90s, you get this flood of bands again that are kind of called power pop. You know, there's kind of this reinvention of the concept of power pop in the 90s with like Material Issue and Greenberry right. Woods and Teenage Fan Club. There's tons of bands. You sure. know, later. But yeah, you were kind of in this period in between where there wasn't a lot of stuff like this.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was odd. I mean, like I said, Crowded House might have been the only thing in that whole era that, you know, I loved legitimately, like as a, you know, as a power pop band. And they were unique too. They were cool. I can still listen to that record. I mean, we did last night. My wife and I played the whole thing last night.
Oh, it's brilliant. Yeah.
It's so good. What a great record. Ugh. But yeah, there wasn't much at the time. I mean, I remember after I got signed, like a week later, I was lying in bed and I said, man, how is this going to work? Nobody knows who I am. I'm not selling out clubs. I'm not doing hair metal. I mean, what the fuck? You know, how is this going to work? And they picked Chance to Be Loved to be the first single, which I thought was a very daring choice because it's such a bizarre, you know, standalone piece of music. I mean, I did write it and produce it, so I liked it. But as a single, I thought it was pretty adventurous. And, you know, they threw it out there. It didn't do much.
Everybody, yeah. The loop in Chicago, figuring 6 million individual lives going by. Wake up from a daydream, it suddenly hits me. A voice inside my head starts to tell me.
That was pretty much it for Columbia's interest. After the first single didn't blow up. The second one was put out half-heartedly. That was Double Our Numbers, which probably should have been the first single.
Yeah, that's my favorite song on the record.
Yeah, I mean, it's really obvious. It's really straight ahead, and it's got a nice story to it. And in fact, if they had given that as much of a push as they tried with Chance to Be Loved, I think something might have happened. But they didn't, so...
Time getting out of bed, a foot off the
voice I knew. You give up on love and the next thing you know it'll come to you. Maybe you know somebody who has given up on love. May they wake up tomorrow in the arms of the one they've been dreaming of. When you're independent, you can be free, but you're free from love, and that's no way to be. When we have our problems, we won't ignore them, we will fight them toe to toe. We make love together, you and I have become one.
Pantheon podcast listeners, Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
You know, what's weird is that I signed to Columbia probably when I was 31. You know, I was already over the hill. and there was nothing really happening like that. I mean, the fact that I had a publisher and a label kind of, you know, that interested in me based on those songs is almost kind of miraculous when you look at it now. I'm still proud of it that I got, that I reached that point only based on songs and not because I was somebody's son or I had an uncle in the business, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's all based on music, and I can hang my hat on that. I wish it had been more successful, of course, but
did the label make a, did they shell out for a video? Was there a
No video, no tour support. And I think it basically came down to, it was a West Coast signing by David Kahn, who, you know, he'd done Fishbone and he'd done Bangles for a different label. No, actually that was Columbia. No, he'd done Bangles. So there's another power pop sort of thing.
True.
But no, I wasn't a high priority signing. I mean, it wasn't like there was a bidding war. It was out of the West Coast. So I had no power. I had no pull at BlackRock in New York, at the main office. So I didn't have any bigwigs on my side. I didn't have, like I said, I didn't have an uncle. I didn't have a college roommate who was a powerful DJ. I just didn't have that magic piece that might have made a difference. I had a handful of people at MCA in Columbia who believed in me. A fairly small budget record, you know, it was like $70,000. It wasn't like $400,000 or anything like that that they used to do. And I think it was one of those that they agreed to take a chance on. And maybe at that level of money, they might have even lost interest when they heard the budget. You know, what are we spending on that? Oh, okay. I don't know. You know what I mean? And what's funny, I look back and I was like 31, 32 during this whole period. I still thought it was the music business and not music business. I really felt I was still just a musician, you know, and the whole business machination around it and what the labels did was a complete mystery to me. You know, we all know a lot more now and we have a lot of perspective on it, but I didn't know how they operated or why they operated like they did. Like, you know, I'd go to the office and they'd say, here's your product supervisor. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All some guy from Texas with a button-down shirt, and it's like, okay, do you know anything about me, or, you know, were you assigned, or do you? I just didn't know what the fuck it was, you know. And we didn't have enough. We didn't have enough money on our own to do a video. In hindsight, I can see, like, why didn't my manager ask MCA to put up some money for a video? You know, whatever. A video probably would have been a good idea, but I think in those days that was like $100,000 to do a video, and that was more than my recording budget. So who knows?
Right, right. But in 1988, I doubt there's a single artist that broke through that didn't have a video. It's like it was an essential. Mm-hmm. How do they think they're going to sell records in 1988 if they don't have a video? Yeah, how are you going to get noticed? You know.
I know, and I think maybe if it had gotten some traction at radio, they probably would have.
Yeah, right.
You know, maybe that was the plan. Well, let's see how it does. Give it 3 weeks. Give it a month, and then we'll see if we want to do that. You know, I don't think it was an easy. I don't think it was an easy sell at the label to spend whatever it was. You know, whatever it would typically be, $100,000 or something on an artist like me. Again, I'm just kind of guessing.
But I've interviewed enough people or listened to enough interviews on podcasts and things there's so many stories where you just like the record label never even tried. It's like, why do they invest any money if they're never even going to try to break the artist? It doesn't make any sense. At least a little effort, you would think.
Well, they took out some ads, you know, yeah. They took out some ads and blah, 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 and you know, did a little push. Whenever there's a situation of any kind, I say, okay, well, first of all, let's establish, were there people involved? Which is the source of everything that goes right or wrong in the world, right? So I think I can imagine that maybe back in 1988, if David Kahn said he wanted to produce a guy named Parthenon Huxley and it was only going to cost $70,000, they probably said, all right. That wasn't like the label saying, great, what do you need? You know, how much video budget do you want? Blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't think it was that kind of situation. It was probably just like, well, let's keep Khan happy. He's not asking for much. We don't have to worry about this, you know?
Right.
You know, it's always in relationships, right? Like, oh, yeah, David's going to make another funny little record.
Right.
You know? So right. Let him do that. He did the Bangles. We'll give him a few of his own little projects, side projects, and then we'll make him do something good again. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Again, I'm just sort of surmising here, but I know that, you know, anything you explore, it always comes down to personal relationships. It always comes down to who's got the ear of the bigwig, or who's good at hustling up some money, or who's whatever. You know, and we weren't that great at it. I think we were pretty thrilled to be on Columbia in the first place. I don't think we had a master plan of how I was going to take over the world.
I mean, at some point, did you become aware in the 90s probably of like the power pop cult that was out there?
Well, you know, skip ahead a few years. And after I worked with E and Kyle Vinson and some other people, and I guess Kyle was later, but when I got left, when I left MCA and I was free to write whatever I wanted to again, because at the last 3 or 4 years there, they wanted me to co-write with people, which is what led me to E and all this other stuff. When I did P Hux and P Hux Deluxe came out and that seemed to really get a response, there started to be these Poptopia festivals out in LA and they started to kind of coalesce as a visible group of people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I always loved Raspberries and The Who and all this other stuff, all this other pop stuff, but I never knew many people, other people who really did, except my close friends. So when the Poptopia festivals and eventually later, you know, David Bash kind of took over the whole concept and has been running with it forever. I would run into people who would say, hey, everybody loves this record. And the internet was just starting and people were starting to talk about P Hux Deluxe on that. And then there was this magazine called Oddities and we were voted, you know, record of the year for 1995, you know, ahead of Matthew Sweet and a bunch of other great bands. So it was like, oh, looks like we're being noticed, you know. P Hux Deluxe was kind of probably the closest thing I had to actual something that was well timed.
Mm-hmm. we compromise. We leave regrets in our hometowns. We build new lives and break them down. And when the perfect vision dies, we say so what to keep from crying. The sky clears and there stands us. We bang our heads, then wonder why we have to laugh.
So how did P-Hux Deluxe happen?
Again, it was a weird kind of confluence of things. Like, I got let go from MCA, so I was jobless. Instead of getting a job like a normal person, I just decided, well, I'll start a new band. I hooked up with this drummer, Gordon Townsend, who I'd heard about from my old bass player. He came over to my house and we played like 2 minutes of music, and I knew he was my favorite drummer ever. He was just spectacular. And he said, you know, I know a bass player who's pretty good. I mean, who's really good, and we'd be lucky to get him. And this guy, Rob Miller. And Gordon and Rob had both played with Tommy Conwell and the Young Rumblers. Do you know who that is?
Yeah, yeah.
Out in Philly.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a story in Rolling Stone that said, on the West Coast was Jane's Addiction, and on the East Coast was Tommy Conwell and the Young Rumblers. They were the two possible next big things. I had this great new band, like, almost instantly. And also, after I left MCA and I stopped writing with other people and I could just write what I wanted to, I was walking my dogs through Elysian Park and, like, practically writing a song a day. I was just on fire again. It was really, really awesome. So I had a new band and a whole bunch of songs. And then I got a call out of the blue. This guy named Matt Heimbold had just graduated UCLA, and he found my number somehow and called me up, and he said, Sunday Nights was my favorite record all throughout college, and I'm starting a record label up in Monterey, and I want you to be my first artist, but you have to promise me you can make a record as good as Sunday Nights. And I said, well, good timing, Matt Heimbold, whoever you are, because I just have a shit pile of great new songs and a great band. So I said, yes, I can do that. He didn't really know what he was doing, so I helped him along and said, here's what we'll do. We'll record basics on tape to analog down here at a very reasonably priced studio. And then his partner had a digital studio with ADATS up in Monterey. And I said, we'll do overdubs at the home studio, which will save you money. And I'll come up to Monterey and we'll do all the stuff up there. So that's how it came about. We recorded all our basics in LA and at great sounding studios. I would drive up to Monterey with a legal pad on the seat next to me in my little truck and listen to the roughs, and I'd jot down overdub ideas on the 5-hour drive, 6-hour drive, And by the time I'd get up to Monterey, I'd probably have two full pages of ideas. And they'd say, so do you know what you want to do? Yep. And so the record just came together fantastic, just beautifully, really easily. And Rob and Gordon were tremendous. And it was just one of those magic kind of albums. I was really confident in all the songs and the performances in my band. And the label was really gung-ho. And they did a real, as a startup indie, I thought they did a great job. They released like three singles and actually got some airplay. And we played at the Greek Theater with Chicago. And we did a few other things and got reasonably popular out in L.A., at least fairly well known. It's hard to make any money out there, but people will come to see you. So the press was, you know, I was getting great press and some radio play, and I had a great band. So it was a really nice rebirth in a way. Thing that happened was that Eric Carmen, he was also on Pioneer in Japan. Okay. And I think at some point they must have given him a bunch of releases from the label, because I had this great moment happen. I don't know, it must have been 15 years ago. When did Raspberries reunite? And you know, they were on tour for about a year with four extra people in the band that they called the Overdubs.
Right.
Maybe 2005, something like that.
Yeah,
but
something
somewhere in there. And I saw my brother and one of my best friends, two of my best friends from growing up in Greece. The four of us went up to see him at maybe House of Blues in Atlantic City. Was there a House of Blues in Atlantic City? Might have been. We went backstage somehow. You know, we're hanging out, and there's Eric Carmen. I always just love the Raspberries. We're all big Raspberries fans. And I said, "Hey, Eric, I'm Parthenon Huxley. I'm just a huge fan." And he goes, "Parthenon Huxley? P. Hux? I love your music."
Wow.
And my brother and two of my best friends were standing there.
Wow.
It was the greatest moment. It was like, see? What Eric Carmen just said. So, and I said, "Yeah, we were on the same label in Japan or something." He said, "Yeah, yeah." And he said, "Yeah, I love your stuff." I went, "Oh my God." So that's kind of the coolest thing that ever came out of that Japan deal.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty great. So you've put out a lot of music since P. Hux Deluxe, right?
Yep.
So have you made a career of it, of music, or, you know?
You mean, do I have a job?
Yeah.
I don't have a job. I have made a career of it, but there's good years and bad years, that's for damn sure.
Right.
And, you know, I made the record after Deluxe was Purgatory Falls, after my wife, Janet, who I had married out in L.A., my second wife, passed away from cancer. And Purgatory Falls was all about that. And that got released by Universal in a digital format. They were trying to move over to digital. And that was reached number one on a chart in Rolling Stone magazine called the Exclusive Download Chart, which I don't know what that chart means, but I was number one.
Right.
So that was kind of cool. I never got much money out of that. And really, I started to make a better living when I got a call out of the blue in 1998 from this guy, Eric Troyer, to audition for ELO Part 2, which I did over in Birmingham, England. And I joined the band and they said, great, learn these 38 songs and we'll see you in Uruguay. And this whole thing came about because I had played a Poptopia festival down in Orange County, south of L.A. And my band, P-Hux, did like five songs. And this guy, Jeffrey Foskett, do you know Jeffrey?
No.
Jeffrey Foskett was in the Beach Boys and Brian Wilson's band and all that. And he's got a bunch of independent records and he does kind of a surf thing. And he was great. And we met backstage and we were admiring each other and becoming best friends and all that kind of crap like musicians do. This guy, Eric Troyer from ELO Part 2, had called Jeffrey Foskett up and said, look, I sang on Double Fantasy by John Lennon. I never got a gold album. And Jeff, I know you're good with the labels. Do you think you can talk to somebody at Geffen to get me a gold album? And he said, yeah, I can talk to somebody there. I'll find you one. And he says, by the way, ELO Part 2 is looking for a guitar player who can sing and write songs. Do you know anybody? And he goes, oh, yeah, P-Hux. Stop the auditions. He's the perfect guy for you. So Foskett really did me a solid. And that was at that little Poptopia festival that I played at that I didn't get paid for. But I tell my music school students that I lecture at occasionally, you never know what's behind the first door. Even if the first door is not paying you anything, you might as well walk through it, you know?
Right.
So then I've been with ELO Part 2 since then. And we're now called the Orchestra, but touring with them I really started to make a decent income. And on years when we have good years with them, it's probably, 60% of my income. And then I've also done production music, like music for film and TV, that earns me royalties. And then I've started teaching about 15 years ago and I still make my records and it all kind of pieces together. I'm kind of a 1099 guy, there's probably seven or eight different 1099s that I do each year. Pretty much adds up to a living. I think if I was living by myself, it would support me completely. But of course I have two kids and a wife, and luckily my wife works.
Right.
So together we have a pretty good living based on her working and the money that I've accumulated from all these different streams. It's not like I have a retirement fund or anything,
right.
But yeah, I've made a career of it. And again, sometimes it's a miracle that it has happened. And other times I feel like it could have been better, but I get to do what I want essentially. And in all its many forms, whether it's working with other people or doing film and television or teaching or playing ELO songs. But yeah, so it's been a really interesting and fun life. Not exactly how I envisioned it or pictured it, but a lot of nice things have happened.
Yeah. I mean, for someone like me who works in a warehouse, that's an amazing success story that you've made a career of music. I mean, that alone is wonderful, so.
It is. And I don't want to, sometimes it's pretty bare bones. And again, I do have a working wife, which makes
right.
a huge difference.
Yeah.
And we can cover ourselves, and we can live a nice life. And I'm not sure what the real, I knew a long time ago I was a terrible employee.
Yeah.
Like, you don't really want to hire me because all I'm doing is thinking about music. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not thinking about your freaking dishes or your, I always just took shitty jobs that I knew I could quit in case something ever happened musically. So I was like a country music DJ. I was a dishwasher at two or three different places, a busboy. I did all sorts of crap jobs. Just knowing that I could do them in my sleep and I could think about music. But there were lean years where it's like, God damn, how did I pay the rent again?
Right.
Sometimes I couldn't even figure it out, but something, I always just felt like something would happen or I'd produce somebody's record or I'd go, get hired to go on tour and something like that always did. Other than COVID stopping us, the orchestra has been on a great run the past like 10 years. We're a fantastic band and we've got a lean touring machine and we do a good payday when we play. And I can't wait for it to resume. I don't know how this sounds, but I think I'm getting better.
Right.
and or at least I haven't atrophied. Like, I know a lot of hit makers who make fantastic records that we all love and we probably both know. When they put out a new record, I'm not real thrilled. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't need to hear another record, you know, and it's I feel like I have somehow outmaneuvered that trend. And I really feel like my records are good. And even very good, and they keep on. I still have something to say, and it might be because I'm not living up to something that's really well known. You know what I mean? Like, I have a few thousand fans who give a shit when my records come out, and I think they're excited to hear no matter what I do. And it's not like A Chance to Be Loved was such a giant hit that if I do anything different from it, people are disappointed.
Right.
So, I'm really excited about that I still have songs coming out of me and it's all the same process that it was from Don't Worry About It Now on. You know, it's never been any different. It's like, oh, hey, this thing in my head sounds really good. I'm going to put it down and I'm going to work on it. And I think I actually have something to say that matches up nicely with the music. And I've got a great local band here. My guys in Maryland are just fantastic players. And there's a great studio right here in town. I've met the guy who I think is really special here in terms of recording. So I've got a nice little situation here in boring, unknown Maryland with a great band, great studio, and still music coming out of me. So this is the one. What's also been really nice is that you probably remember when the internet was just kind of a blip and a bleep, and you know, we couldn't imagine what it would turn into, but
yeah.
Kickstarter, I mean, that to me, like when I first did Kickstarter maybe 7 years ago or whatever it was, I just couldn't believe how well the internet worked.
Right.
Like, God, you can actually pitch a project and people will send you money. And I've done two Kickstarter things. And, you know, the first one was like $15,000. Second was $17,000. You know, that's a modest album budget, but it really helps because I still use live musicians in real studios. I'm not doing everything in the box. And I can still make a professional record based on the way I was brought up in real studios. I can still recreate that. And I know it's anachronistic now. I'm not really, you know, I'm not doing hip hop or pop music or anything like that. I'm still doing what I do, but I think I do it really well. And I'm really, really, really happy with my last record. This is the one. I think it sounds exactly like I wanted it to. And that's kind of been the baseline for everything I've ever done. It sounds like it's the best I can do at that time. You know what I mean?
This is the one. This is the one. This is the one. This is the one. This is the one.
I feel like those records, the records I make, are the one thing in life that I really do that to the full extent. Like every, it's got to be perfect from beginning to end. Not perfect, but it's got to be what I want from the beginning to end. And I do that more with almost anything else in my life. It's the one area where I'm kind of a control freak, and it has to be, there's a real standard that it has to reach. I can let a lot of other stuff in my life slide, like exercising or, you know, whatever, but my records, I really stand behind for what it's worth, you know?
Yeah. I write songs, and the big problem is I can never get, if I try to do it on GarageBand or something, it's never what I want or what I hear in my head.
Yeah. And
having a band in a studio, that's really the only way to do it, I think, to try to get what's in your head on tape, probably.
That's the only way that's worked for me. I mean, I think being in the box is really cool for lots of stuff. I mean, you know, Billie Eilish's brother is really good at it. And yeah. All the hip hop guys are fucking amazing at it. You know, I feel like I would be kind of a dilettante if I went into that world. The world I know really well is I'm an anachronistic, you know, late 20th century recording artist. That's what I am. I fully embrace it. I fully understand it. And that means great live musicians in a room. And that's what it sounds like in my head anyway. So, you know, why would I want to, that's what it is. So I feel you. And if, you know, I hope, have you ever worked in a studio? I mean, have you ever recorded?
No, I haven't.
You got to do that, Brian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Music, you know, it's the greatest thing on earth, and it's just a terrible business, you know, which is probably how it ought to be. If the greatest things on earth were easy, they wouldn't be the greatest things on earth. I don't know. I try to picture my life without music, and it's unfathomable, you know, the joy I get from it, and the sustenance, and the emotion, and the heartache, and everything that it provides is just the food of my life. I can't, maybe that's why I just couldn't do anything else. You know, I just really wanted to be in it. And even though I was never a planner or like, I know where I'm going to be in 5 years, that was never me. But I just always wanted to hear that next thing that was in my head. I needed to hear it out there, you know, like get it out there. And I'd become a good enough player. I was always kind of a good enough singer and player, you know, I could do that to an extent. And that's improved over the years too. I've gotten to be a really good player and a much better singer because I work with people who are better than me. And, got my ass kicked a little bit, you know. I said, oh, I see where I have to step up my game. Like, don't sing out of tune anymore. But yeah, it's an amazing thing, music.
There's nothing else. There's nothing like it that can give you that adrenaline rush, that instant adrenaline, or instantly have you in tears. You know, I mean, I guess not everybody's like that, but for me, it's like, yeah, there's nothing else like it that can have such an effect on you in so many different ways.
So, yeah. Instantaneous, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's incredible. It's hardwired into our, whatever that thing up inside our head is, however that crazy thing is wired, you know, it's music is, it just lights up parts of the brain that make you feel good, that release endorphins, I guess, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's bizarre. And there's only 12 notes, which is another mystery. How do you make all that great shit out of that?
For me, it's melody. That's what I love. You know?
Yeah.
I can't listen to jazz or I don't really care about instrumental music. It's like what I love is songwriting and melody. That's what has an effect on me. And who knows where it comes from or why it's like that. I don't know why I've loved music. It's been like my favorite thing since I was a kid. I don't really know why, you know. My parents weren't into it or anything like that. So,
yeah, same. Absolute same.
Yeah.
My parents were listening to Ray Conniff.
My dad didn't even listen to music. My dad will drive in the car in silence and not even have the radio on.
It's crazy. Because I have music in my head. It drives my wife crazy. So, can I put something on? I said, no, I'm working on something.
All right. Yeah. But, yeah, I've heard other people talk about that. I have the same thing. You'll be writing a song in your head. Just all day long. There's always a song playing. It's really weird, but
mm-hmm.
yeah.
No, I know. And eventually it just kind of gets to the point where, okay, better put this down. And sometimes it's immediate, you know, I'll wake up with a riff or something, or come down here to my office and put it on my phone at least, you know?
Right. Well, that's one thing I'm jealous of is musicians who can take what's in their head and just play it on the guitar or whatever. That's not something I can really pull off, but
yeah, it's a nice thing. I've gotten to the point where it's pretty much no matter what I'm hearing in my head, I can get it down. Right. And that's a real blessing. I mean, when I was first coming up, I was like, what the hell is this in my head? I had no idea what these chords are.
Right.
But after 40, 50 years, you get good at it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but this has been really great talking to you. I really appreciate it. Yeah. I mean, it's been great.
Thanks, Brian. Pleasure to meet you.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.